That means that we are now in the final chapter, not just for the unit, but for the course. And this one is called the chromosomal basis of inheritance. One of the earlier chapters was called the molecular basis of inheritance. We looked at things at the molecular level. Here we're paying attention. We're viewing things from the perspective of the chromosome. And the opening slide is a cross that we've looked at before. This is exactly the same cross using peas. What kind of cross is this? We talked about it in a different chapter. What kind of cross is this? Well, what are some possible types of crosses that you know? It is a hybrid cross. What kind of hybrid cross? Dihybrid. Yes, it's a dihybrid cross. And the di meaning two refers to what? For any given dihybrid cross, not just this one. What does the di mean? Or what does it refer to? To what? Not the two parents. Even a monohybrid cross has two parents. Because sexual species, you have two parents. That's the reason you have two parents. So di does mean two, but it's referring to two what?
Characteristics.
Right. Two characteristics, or correspondingly, two genes. Right? So what are the characteristics here? Right, seed color and seed shape. Now, this is, do you remember this cross at all? So there's two different characteristics. Each one has two traits associated with it. So there's two colors, yellow and green. Yellow is dominant. Two textures, smooth and wrinkled. Smooth is dominant. And so this is not only a dihybrid cross, but each of the two parents is a double homozygous individual. The yellow round one is a double homozygous dominant. The green wrinkled one is a double homozygous recessive. So they're both true breeding for each of the two characteristics. And that's why their genotypes are either all upper or all lowercase. Right? Makes sense, hopefully, that there are four letters here because there are two genes. And each gene in a diploid is going to have a genotype that has two letters. All right, so that's all review. The only thing that's been added here are pictures of the corresponding chromosomes, just to make sense of it from the chromosome perspective. Now, these pictures of the cells here of the parents, the P's, P generation, those do not mean that pea plants have an N of 2. I don't actually know what the N of the pea plant species is, but it's more than two. Just keep in mind, we're not paying attention to any gene other than these two. So all the other genes, all of the other chromosomes, that is, are just not even shown here because we're ignoring them. But notice that these two genes are on that we are paying attention to have their loci, which is the plural of locus, on two different chromosomes, which doesn't have to be the case. They could be on the same chromosome, right? But they're on separate chromosomes here, and that's why we're paying attention to exactly two chromosomes, one that is carrying the Y along with thousands of other genes, and one of them that's carrying the R gene along with thousands of other genes. Okay. And it's a diploid. These parents are diploid, which is why there are two R-carrying chromosomes and two Y-carrying chromosomes. What do the black marks represent? The alleles at a specific position or locus. That's correct. Remember that an allele is really just a small sequence of the overall chromosomal sequence. Okay, well, these are true breeders. So if they're going to breed, each one of them has to first make a gamete via meiosis, and meiosis randomly chooses one or the other. Well, up to this point, we've been treating alleles as though they're individual things. We say that you choose one allele or the other. Meiosis doesn't choose alleles independently, right? It chooses a whole chromosome that the allele is part of. So it's choosing either of these Y-carrying chromosomes and either of the R-carrying chromosomes, but since they're true breeders, it doesn't matter which one is chosen. That's why there's, with respect to just these two characteristics or two genes, each of these parents is only able to make one kind of gamete. That's another way of saying it's true breeding. And the gametes, notice, are haploid, so each one of them has only one of each of the two chromosomes. But these are the only two possible gametes, so when you get those together, there's only one possible type of offspring when all you care about are these two genes. It's going to make every F1 individual a double heterozygote, upper lower Y, upper lower R, which explains why they're all phenotypically the same in the F1. They're all the dominant color, and they're all the dominant shape, because it only takes one dominant allele to make you fully dominant. So that's all just review, but you see the corresponding chromosomes here. Then we cross the F1s together, and that's where some more new information emerges on the slide. So you have these two boxes, two laws here, which are actually Mendel's laws. He came up with these, even though he had no idea what chromosomes were. The so-called law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. And both of these really just describe things he didn't know about meiosis either, because he didn't know things microscopically. But both of these laws really just describe events that happen in meiosis, but specifically what parts of meiosis. Well, the law of independent assortment is obviously must have something to do with independent assortment, which we've already talked about, right? So let's remind ourselves what independent assortment is. What does that refer to? Well, what about just assortment by itself? What does that specifically refer to? Genetically. That's right. How something lines up is assortment. But what is the something that is lining up one way or another? Not individual chromosomes, no.
Chromatids.
Not individual chromatids. Not replicated chromosomes. Homologous pairs, and what's a one-word synonym for homologous pairs? When they are together. When those pairs are together, the two versions of the number 3, for instance, make up one what? Tetrad. Tetrad means a four-part thing, and it makes sense because there are four overall chromatids, right, in a homologous pair of replicated chromosomes. Okay, two sister chromatids and then two sister chromatids on the other homolog. Well, I went through all of that because it's tetrads that are assorting or lining up one way or the other at the metaphase plate. So independent assortment, first of all, refers specifically to metaphase. But remember that there are two metaphases in meiosis, not just one like in mitosis. So which part of meiosis are we in here when we're talking about independent assortment? Meiosis 1. So specifically metaphase 1 of meiosis is where you have independent assortment. Assortment by itself, though, simply refers to how a tetrad lines up. There's two possibilities. Red up and blue down, blue up and red down in the cartoon version. Right? Well, that's assortment. Independent assortment means that how one tetrad aligns doesn't have anything to do with how other tetrads are aligning. Each tetrad flips its own coin. If it were dependent assortment, that would mean the cell flips one coin. And it's either all blue up and all red down, or all red up and all blue down. But it's not that. It's independent assortment because each tetrad flips its own coin. And that's why there are so many more possibilities. How many possibilities did I say there are in general for independent assortment? How do you figure that out mathematically? No, but n is involved. It's 2 raised to the n minus 1. Do you remember that formula? This is why if n is 1, it's only one possibility. 2 to the 0 is 1. But as soon as there's 2 possibilities. And then 3, there's 4 possibilities. 4, there's 8 possibilities, and so on. It doubles every time you add a different kind of chromosome. That's why for us, it's 2 to the 22nd power. Anyway, that's what law of independent assortment refers to. And that's specifically happening at metaphase 1 of meiosis. Mendel's law of segregation, as you see here, states that the 2 alleles for a single gene, for each gene, separate, which is what segregate means, during gamete formation. So he figured out that there are 2 versions, because he didn't know what a gene was or a chromosome, two particles that a parents have, and they separate during gamete formation and get passed individually to offspring. But that's called the law of segregation, and that specifically refers to what part of meiosis? When is that happening? No. Anaphase 2 does involve a separation of things. But what gets separated during anaphase 2? Metaphase doesn't involve a separation or a segregation. Metaphase 1 is when we have independent assortment. So you're right in saying anaphase, because anaphase is when separation occurs, whether it's meiosis or mitosis. But there's 2 anaphases in meiosis, right? You said anaphase 2. Well, what separates in meiosis 2, anaphase 2, are chromatids that are still stuck together. They separate from each other. That's not what the law of segregation refers to. Law of segregation refers to anaphase 1. What is it that separate during anaphase 1? Well, not independently, no. The tetrads line up, and then what separates?
Chromosome.
Yes, the homologous, the homologs, two in each tetrad, separate from each other and go to separate cells. So the law of segregation says the 2 alleles for each gene separate. But that's kind of misleading because it kind of sounds like every gene is an individual particle. It is true that the 2 alleles separate from each other, but really what are separating are the 2 chromosomes homologous to each other. And the alleles are just passengers on those chromosomes. Very similar to being passengers on ships. Right? They're not in their own boats. The allele for seed color here is one of many passengers on the same chromosome. And the other allele is in a different ship, which is also carrying the same number of passengers, right? But different passengers. So it's not, so saying that alleles separate is acting like they're in their own rowboats. They're really just members of a ship. And what separate are the entire ships from each other. And what's ever on that ship goes one way, and what's ever on the other ship goes the other way. Okay? But because of independent assortment, that means in a dihybrid cross, there are all four possible combinations of traits for these two characteristics possible in the F2. Which is why we have some that are round and smooth. Yellow and round. Some that are yellow and, green and round. Some that are yellow and wrinkled. And some that are green and wrinkled. All four possibilities. Now in two, we're going to switch to animals for a little bit. And talk about fruit flies. These are fruit flies in cartoon form at the top. Real photographs of their eyes. Fruit flies are from a genus called Drosophila. And Drosophila are used in a lot of genetic experiments. They are a model organism. A model organism is something that is well suited to experimentation for various reasons. And one thing that makes Drosophila a good species to work with for genetic experiments is simply that they're really easy to care for. They don't die very easily, right? And you don't really have to put any effort into having fruit flies. All you have to do is peel a banana and wait, and they'll be there. But in a laboratory setting, they don't die very easily. So that's one important thing. But also, especially for genetics, it's important that they have a short life cycle, sexual life cycle. So one generation is just a week. And therefore, if you use these for a year, you can go through 50 generations, which can give you a hell of a lot of information about mutation or whatever. Anyway, that's why they're used in a lot of experiments, not just this one we're going to look at. But here we're concentrating on an eye color gene. And this one on the left is the so-called wild type. I've used that term before. And remember that wild type simply means the type that you find most often in a natural population. Now, this also happens to be the dominant type. The dominant trait is this red color. And, if you do get fruit flies in your house, they're not so small that you can't look at them and see with the naked eye that they have red eyes, most of them. But anyway, this wild type is also dominant, which by the way does not have to be the case. It's possible for the wild type to actually be recessive. It's just not here. Okay, so red eye in the left, white eye on the left. On the right. The white-eyed individual is called a mutant simply because it differs from the wild type. Okay, now let's look at what's really happening here in slide 3. I need to give you some new definitions. The characteristic that we're looking at here, which is eye color in fruit flies, is an example of a sex-linked characteristic, which I'm not going to define yet, but I will in a second. I have to give you a couple other definitions before I can make sense of this definition. So I want you to think back to the picture of the human karyotype that we looked at. Remember, a karyotype is a photographic representation of its orderly arrangement of diploid chromosomes from biggest to smallest. And so they show you what N is for the species, how many there are. Well, N, whatever it is for the species, is how many different kinds of chromosomes there are. But more broadly speaking, in any given sexual species, there are two possible categories of chromosomes. And those are autosomes and sex chromosomes. Any given type of chromosome is one or the other. Now, what does auto mean, by the way? Right. Auto means self. So autosomes get their name because their genes are all about characteristics having to do with that individual's own life. Sex chromosomes are called this because, even though this is not the only thing they do, sex chromosomes in one way or another determine the sex of any offspring, which is not that person's self, but the next generation. That's why they're called that. Okay? So like the X and the Y in humans are sex chromosomes. And if you went back to that karyotype picture that I foolishly didn't have up to show you, there are 23 kinds of chromosomes in that because it's a human example and N is 23 for humans. But the numbers, which show you the types, 1, 2, 3, and so on, they stop at 22. The 23rd one isn't called 23. It was called, in that version, X and Y because that happened to be a male. So there, in humans, there are 22 kinds of autosomes, is what I'm getting across, and one sex chromosome. There's two types of sex chromosomes, but there's one sex chromosome. Okay? Well, now back to the sex-linked definition. A sex-linked gene, if it is sex-linked, simply means that that gene resides on a sex chromosome rather than being on an autosome. So remember, any given gene is always found in the same place, on one of the chromosomes, at a specific locus on a specific chromosome. The vast majority of genes are autosomal genes because it's much more likely to be on an autosome than a sex chromosome simply because there's a lot more autosomes than sex chromosomes. Okay, so that's what sex-linked means. Simply, a gene that is on a sex chromosome. Being on a sex chromosome does not mean that a gene has anything to do with sex, because the sex chromosomes do more than determine the sex of the offspring. But it matters, even if the gene does not have anything to do with sex determination, it matters that it's on a sex chromosome compared to an autosome for a reason that's explained in this slide. Okay? So any given gene is either sex-linked or autosomal. Autosomal simply means it's part of an autosome. Now when we look at this at the top, before you get to the conclusion, this looks like it's the standard Mendelian example. This looks just like a standard monohybrid cross in Mendelian genetics, like the first one we looked at with flower color, purple versus white. Because all of the F1s look the same, just like they were all purple flowered. And then when you cross those, you get a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant to recessive phenotypes. But this is not at all what that normal Mendelian case. Just looking at what we have listed here above conclusion, what do we have shown here that we didn't show in the pea plant experiment, the flower color one? What's the information that's listed here that we didn't have then? Right. For flower color in pea plants, we did not say one parent was male or female and the other was the other. Of course, one of them was male and one was female, but it didn't matter whether the purple-flowered one was female or vice versa. Here we have specifically the red-eyed one is the female. This is the female symbol. The white-eyed one is the male. The reason we didn't list it, we didn't list sex in the pea plant example is because it did not matter at all. You could do it either way, and you would get, in the F2, a 3-to-1 ratio. But that 3-to-1 ratio is irrespective of sex. meaning that if you got 1,000 offspring in the F2, you would expect 500 of them to be male and 500 of them to be female, because there's an even chance of both, right? But the 3-to-1 ratio means that 3/4 of those 500 females would be pink, purple flowered, 1/4 of the females white flowered, same for the males. That is not at all what happens here. Okay? Notice that all of the females in the F2 are red-eyed, half of the males are red-eyed, and half of them are white-eyed. So that's totally different. Here's why, though. Let's look at what's happening at the chromosomal level. Like I said, this eye color is in fruit flies is an example of a sex-linked trait. Well, we humans use the XY system. Not all animals do. But fruit flies happen to also use the XY, so it works the same in them. And speaking of the X and Y chromosomes, even though they are the same type of chromosome, and in fact we use the word homologous because the X and Y correspond to each other, they are not truly homologous like autosomes are. To be truly homologous, the two homologs have to have the same number of chromosomes. I mean, the same number of genes, which is why they're the same size, right? So for autosomes, there is true homology. But for sex chromosomes, the reason that they're not truly homologous is that they're not the same size. One is bigger than the other, and it happens to be the X that is much bigger than the Y. So they don't have the same number of genes. There are some genes, a small number, that are on both X and Y. But most genes that are on the X aren't on the Y at all. There just isn't a corresponding part on that smaller chromosome. And that's what messes up the genetics as far as predictions are concerned. All right? So, if you think of an autosomal gene, we've already discussed three phrases that we can use to describe the genotypes. What are those three phrases? What are the three possibilities for any given individual when we're talking about one gene on an autosome? Well, there's three genotypes possible, right? Three diploid genotypes that are possible for a diploid individual. What are the three corresponding phrases that we use to describe those? Right. Any individual for an autosome, any diploid individual is either homozygous dominant, heterozygous, or homozygous recessive. No other possibilities. Well, for a male, and I should say, by the way, in the XY system, in case you don't already know, males are XY, they have one of each chromosome, and females are XX. So, based on what I was just talking about earlier about the size difference between the two, this means that a male, which has one X and one Y, has only one of any of its sex-linked genes, one allele only, because there isn't a version on the Y, whereas a female has two. So those three phrases you just mentioned, those can be applied to a female because she has two of each sex-linked gene. Two alleles for each sex-linked gene. But a male does not. He has only one. So it would be foolish to call a male, if you're talking about a sex-linked gene, to call a male homozygous, whether it's dominant or recessive. Because homozygous means both are the same. Well, he doesn't have two. He can't use the word both. And you can't use heterozygous because that means the two are different and he doesn't have two. So we had to come up with a different word to describe a male when you're talking about a sex-linked gene. And that word is hemizygous. Hemi means half. He has one allele, which is half the amount that the female has, because she has two. All right. And notice, by the way, that dominance and recessivity don't really matter in a male, because dominance and recessivity refers to one allele's influence over the other. He only has one. So whichever version he has, that uniquely determines his trait. Okay, now let's look at these parents. She is a true breeding wild type, red eye. So she is homozygous dominant. The W here, this is yet another genotype standard that they use. The W here really refers to white, which is the recessive. But if you put a plus superscript, that means instead of actually being white, it's the wild type. So W plus is the genotype that is homozygous dominant, red eye, female. And this chromosome, which is the only one we're paying attention to because it's the only one carrying this gene we're interested in, is the X chromosome. Well, what makes her a female is that she has two X's. So these chromosomes not only determine the eye color, because that's where the gene is, but they also determine the sex of the individual. He is a male because he has an X and a Y. And because X has the eye color, but Y doesn't, he's hemizygous, and he happens to have the white allele, W, by itself, and that's what makes it white-eyed. Now, when you get these two together, the female is true breeding. So she really can only make one kind of egg. It doesn't matter which of these X chromosomes gets chosen. Every one of her eggs is carrying an X chromosome, and since she's true breeding, it's carrying a red-eye allele. That's why there's only one row in this Punnett square. This is really only one possibility. He, though, is a male, so he can make a sperm that has the X chromosome or a sperm that has the Y chromosome. All right? Now, that matters to the offspring, because if you get an egg with the X and a sperm with an X together, that's going to make that individual zygote an XX, and therefore a female. So this Punnett square says all females should be red-eyed because they're all heterozygous. And we saw that right here. They're all red-eyed, all the females, but all of them. The other half of the Punnett square says that all the males should be red-eyed because they're hemizygous. Notice that a male offspring has to get its X chromosome from its mother. Because it's XY, the only way you can get a Y is from a father, so the X has to come from the mother. And that's why he's red-eyed, because the mother had only red-eyed Xs to give. Okay, so that explains why all the F1s are red-eyed, but for a more complicated reason compared to the purple-flowered ones. Now we mate these two. They are, well, the females among them can make now two different kinds of eggs. Each egg is carrying an X, of course. But one of them is carrying red, one of them is carrying white. Every male, once again, can make two different kinds of sperm, but it's going to be a red-carrying X and a non-color-carrying Y. So now what the Punnett square tells us is that every one of the females, which is this half, should be red-eyed, but half of them should be true-breeding red-eyed, homozygous dominant. Half of them should be heterozygous. So that's why there's two females listed here, both with red eyes. These are homozygous dominant. These are heterozygous. They look the same, though. This says that half of the males should be red-eyed, hemizygous, and half of them should be white-eyed, hemizygous. That's what these two are for. So it's not really the typical 3-to-1 ratio. This is a sex-linked characteristic. You also find, if you read about sex-linkedness, they'll say sometimes X-linked. That is also sex-linked. It's just specifically X-linked. I mean, X-linked is specifically sex-linked for a species that uses XY. Not all do use X and Y. Sex-linked is the more general term. Well, 4 shows you a photomicrograph of the two. These are actually human ones, not Drosophila ones. But you can see here that the X is much bigger than the Y. So all of these genes on these parts, where there is no corresponding part, those are the ones that really matter to sex linkedness. And so that brings us to five, which surveys just a few examples of sex determination mechanisms. This is not at all an exhaustive list. For one thing, it shows only animals, and animals are only one kind of sexual species, right? Plants are not there, algae are not there, and so on. But also, even for animals, this isn't all of them. This is just a tiny sampling that shows you some different ways that sex can be determined in different organisms, different species. The XY system is what we use. It also works for fruit flies, as we just talked about. But let's look at the XY for humans. Notice that the parents there have genotypes listed. What does 44 mean? A male is listed as 44 plus XY. A female has 44 plus XX. What does 44 refer to? This is humans. Yes, there are 44 overall autosomes, which is the same thing as autosomal chromosome, just in one word. 44, but why 44? Where did that come from? How many kinds of autosomes are in humans? 22. This is a diploid human, though, right? So there's 22 kinds of autosomes, but there's two of each of them. Two number ones, two number twos, through two number 22s. That's 44. And then the 23rd kind of chromosome is a sex chromosome, which you also have two of in a diploid. For a male, it's an X and a Y. For a female, it's an X and an X. So that means when humans produce their gametes, a female can produce only one kind of egg with respect to sex chromosomes, right? Every egg has to contain an X because she only has X's to give. Whereas a male can make two different kinds of sperm with respect to sex chromosomes, a sperm that has an X or a sperm that has a Y. This is why in the XY system, including humans, it's the male who determines the sex of the offspring, which you've probably heard about in human reproduction. Right? Two gametes have to get together, so they all both have to contribute a sex chromosome, but the mother is going to give an X, definitely. The father's going to give an X or a Y. If he gives an X, then the offspring is XX, a female, a daughter. If he gives a Y, it's going to be XY, a son. All right. That's the XY system. Grasshoppers, shown below, use the so-called X0 system. This is most people say XO, which is fine, but it's really a zero because it stands for nothing. They're different from us. They do have X chromosomes, but they don't have Y chromosomes. And so 22 plus XX means that there are 11 autosomes in this species. Two of each of them. And if you have an X and an X sex chromosome, that makes you female, just like for us. But unlike in us, a male is an individual that has two of each autosome, but just one sex chromosome, one of the X. There's only one kind of sex chromosome, and what matters is whether you have just one or two of them. Okay, so X by itself makes a male in this species. Below that is the ZW system, which most birds use, including the owls that we were studying, right? We already talked about the ZW system. It's exactly like X and Y, except they're called Z and W, and except for which sex actually has the two different ones, and which sex has two of the same. XY system, it's the female that has two of the same, but in birds, it's the male that has two of the same, and what he has are two Zs. A female has a Z and a W. That's why for a female, you got two bands in the electrophoresis gel. But this also means that for birds, it's the female parent that determines the sex of the offspring, because she can make two different kinds of eggs, a Z or a W. Okay, that's pretty clear cut. The weirdest one from our point of view is the bottom one, which is in some social insects like these bees, so-called haplodiploid system, which does not have any sex chromosomes. There are two sexes for the species, but there are no sex chromosomes. And so look at these genotypes. 32, because there are 16 types of autosomes. All there are autosomes. There are no sex chromosomes. But 32 means that there are two of each of them. It's a diploid individual. Well, it's the diploidy that actually determines the sex. So a diploid individual will be female. Whereas an individual that has only one of each autosome, 16, a haploid individual will be a male. Now, this is weird for a few reasons. It's not weird that haploid cells get produced. That's what our gametes are, right? For all animals produce haploid gametes for the reasons we discussed before, because when you get them together, you're going to double the ploidy, so they better be haploid to start with so that you can only make a diploid zygote. But think about human gametes. Whether it's an egg or a sperm, it's a haploid human that is not going to live very long compared to a diploid human. It's going to live its whole life as either an egg or a sperm and then either die, or if fertilization takes place, it ends its life by becoming a zygote. Right? But the point here is that women produce eggs, whether they want to have children or not. And those eggs just don't turn into diploid. They don't turn into multicellular humans unless they're fertilized, in which case they're no longer eggs, right? Well, bees lay eggs too, just like human females. But unlike human females, an unfertilized bee egg can actually develop, can undergo rounds of mitosis to become multicellular and develop into an adult bee. So a bee can reproduce either sexually or asexually. If she lays eggs without mating, those will be unfertilized eggs, which would in us just die. But they independently become haploid adult male bees, because that's what it means to be male, to be haploid. Unfertilized eggs become males. On the other hand, if she chooses to mate, then she's going to produce fertilized eggs or zygotes, which are diploid, and those therefore are going to be daughters. She can either have all sons by not mating, or she can have daughters if she mates. All right. And what that means is that a male bee does not have a father, and it cannot have sons. A male bee has no father, because if it had a father, then that bee would be diploid, getting gametes from both parents. And that if he were diploid, then it wouldn't be a male, it would be a female, right? So he doesn't have a father, and he can't have sons. He can mate, but if he mates, he's going to produce a diploid offspring, which will be a daughter, not a son. Even though he doesn't have a father and can't have sons, a male does have a grandfather, and he can have grandsons. Right? All bees have a mother, including a male. A male's mother has to have a father because she's diploid. So, right? So his mother's father is his grandfather. And similarly, his daughter can choose to mate. I mean, can choose not to mate and have sons. Her sons are going to be his grandson. but he can't have sons, or and he doesn't have a father. So it's weird from our point of view, but it works well for them. And I think I'm just going to stop there for today. I'll finish the rest of this next time.